A psychologist is sitting in the stands at a junior hockey game in Canada in the mid-1980s. He is bored. He picks up the program, the one with the roster and the players' details, and his wife glances at it over his shoulder and says something that will eventually sell millions of books. She says, "Look at the birthdays. Today, Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell." In two sentences, successful people are not self-made, they are the product of hidden advantages, lucky timing, and cultural inheritance they did not choose and usually cannot see. Change the birthday, change the opportunity, change the culture, and the outlier becomes ordinary. And this is the episode where the book's own argument turns out to describe something the book never mentions: how children get diagnosed with a DHD. From the Reading Room, this is 60 Books. I'm Miles. 60 of the best management books of the last 100 years, one per episode, read for leaders and teams who think differently, and for work where AI is now part of the job. Today's is not a management book. It is on more executive shelves than most management books are, and it gave the business world one number that will not die. Nora, start with the hockey program.
So the psychologist is Roger Barnsley, and he is at a game with his wife, Paula. She is reading the roster, and she notices the birth dates are strange. Not a little strange. Almost every player is born in January, February, or March.
Almost every player.
They go home and check. They pull rosters for the whole league. The pattern is everywhere. In elite Canadian junior hockey, roughly 40% of players are born in the first quarter of the year, and only about 10% in the last quarter.
Why?
Because the eligibility cutoff for Canadian youth hockey is January 1st. So a boy born on January 2nd and a boy born on December 31st play in the same league. At 9 years old, that is nearly a full year of growth. He is bigger, faster, better coordinated. So he gets picked for the All-Star team. The All-Star team practices three times as much, plays better competition, gets better coaching.
And by 14?
By 14, he actually is better. The advantage was manufactured, and then it compounded into a real one. Gladwell calls it the Matthew effect, from the verse about those who have been given more.
Let me say the obvious thing. The Canadian junior hockey development system is, functionally, astrology.
With body checking.
With body checking. Now, this is the show where we ask what a book means for neurodivergent leaders and teams, and normally I would hold that. I am not holding it, because this chapter is not really about hockey.
No, it is about arbitrary cutoffs producing real and lasting differences. And there is a research literature that found the same effect somewhere that matters a great deal more than a hockey roster.
Go.
In 2024, a team at the University of Nottingham, Frasera, Holland, and Sale published a systematic review and meta-analysis in European child and adolescent psychiatry. 32 studies. They found that the youngest children in a school year, the ones with birthdays just before the enrollment cutoff, carry a relative risk of about 1.38 for being diagnosed with a DHD, and about 1.28 for being prescribed medication for it.
Same mechanism, the cutoff date.
The same mechanism. A 5-year-old who is 11 months younger than the child beside him is less able to sit still, wait his turn, and hold attention because he is 11 months younger. And there is a detail in that meta-analysis that tells you exactly where the judgment is happening. The relative age effect shows up in teacher ratings of symptoms. It does not show up in parent ratings.
The teacher sees the child next to 25 other children.
The parent sees the child next to himself. The review also found the youngest in the year were more likely to receive an autism diagnosis, though that rests on only 2 studies, so hold it loosely.
So Gladwell's hockey chapter is a description of a diagnostic bias he never wrote about.
And the leadership lesson is identical in both. If your system sorts people early, on a criterion that is partly noise, it will manufacture the difference it believes it is measuring.
The author.
Malcolm Gladwell, born 1963 in England, raised in rural Ontario. His father Graham was a mathematics professor. His mother Joyce is a Jamaican psychotherapist and a writer, and she matters to this book because the epilogue is about her family. He studied history at the University of Toronto.
Then journalism.
The Washington Post for about a decade, Business and Then Science, than The New Yorker from 1996, where he still writes. The Tipping Point in 2000, Blink in 2005, Outliers in 2008, and in 2016 he started the podcast Revisionist History, which is arguably where his best work has happened since.
Give me the human detail.
He was a serious runner as a teenager, an Ontario champion at 1500 meters, and there is a story he tells about his hair. He grew it out long and curly, and within a short stretch he started getting pulled over, getting stopped, getting treated differently, including extra attention at airports. Nothing about him had changed except the hair.
And that became a book.
That observation, that people were reading him instantly and wrongly, is what sent him toward Blink. A haircut generated a bestseller.
Chapter 2 is the famous one.
The 10,000-hour rule. Gladwell takes research on expert performance, largely from the psychologist Anders Ericsson and colleagues studying violinists at a Berlin academy, and compresses it into a number. Roughly 10,000 hours of practice separates the elite from everyone else.
The examples.
Bill Joy, who wrote much of Berkeley Unix, gets access to a rare-time sharing computer at Michigan in the early 70s and accumulates enormous hours. The Beatles play Hamburg, sometimes 8 hours a night, 7 nights a week, and come home a different band. Bill Gates gets into Lakeside School in Seattle in 1968, which happens to have a computer terminal, at a moment when almost no school in the world had one.
And the birth year observation.
This is the part that holds up best. The founding generation of personal computing clusters around 1955. Gates, Paul Allen, Steve Ballmer, Steve Jobs, Eric Schmidt, Bill Joy, all born within a couple of years of each other. Old enough to be adults when the microcomputer arrived in 1975, young enough to have nothing to lose. Born in 1950, you already have a career at IBM. Born in 1960, you missed it.
Now the neurodivergent read on 10,000 hours.
Two directions, and they pull against each other. The first is that deep, sustained, self-directed practice in a narrow domain is a recognizable feature of a lot of neurodivergent lives. We talked in episode 3 about monotropism, the theory from Dinah Murray and colleagues describing attention that concentrates into a few interests at unusual depth, and about the hyper-focus literature. If attention pools naturally into one thing, the hours accumulate without discipline being the reason.
So the hours can be a byproduct rather than achievement.
Which changes what a leader should be looking for. If you meet someone who has spent 4,000 hours on an obscure system that happens to be your obscure system, you have found something rare, and no credential will tell you it is there.
And the second direction.
Warning. Gladwell's real argument is not that anyone can put in 10,000 hours, it is that almost nobody gets the chance. The hours require access, time, equipment, and somebody paying the bills. The neurodivergent version of that is unemployment and underemployment, which run high for autistic adults in particular. Nobody accumulates hours in a job they cannot get.
Which is Collins's bus problem from episode 1.
It is exactly that. Collins said, get the right people on the bus. Gladwell is showing you the boarding gate was rigged years earlier.
Chapters 3 and 4, Geniuses.
Gladwell goes after IQ. He starts with Lewis Terman, who in the 1920s identified about 1,500 high IQ California schoolchildren and followed them for life, expecting to produce a generation of eminent figures. He did not. The group did well on average, but the geniuses never appeared, and two future Nobel laureates had been screened out of the sample for scoring too low.
And his argument.
A threshold effect. Above roughly 120, more IQ stops predicting much more achievement. Past that point, something else decides. He illustrates it with two men. Robert Oppenheimer, who as a graduate student tried to poison his tutor and talked his way into probation. And Chris Langan, a man with an extraordinarily high IQ who lost a college scholarship after his mother missed a financial aid deadline. Tried and failed to get a class schedule changed, and ended up working as a bouncer.
Same raw material.
Wildly different outcomes. Gladwell's term for the difference is practical intelligence, and he leans on the sociologist Annette Lariot, who watched families across social classes and found two patterns. Middle-class parents practiced what she called concerted cultivation, scheduling, negotiating, teaching children to question authority and ask institutions for things. Working-class parents practiced what she called the accomplishment of natural growth. Children were loved, fed, and largely left to their own devices. Both raise fine people. Only one teaches a child how to work a bureaucracy.
This one is close to home.
It is the entire accommodation system in one chapter. Every accommodation at school or at work requires exactly what Langan lacked: knowing the process exists, asking the right person, phrasing it the way institutions accept, pushing when told no. That is a learned social skill. It is not distributed evenly, and it is often hardest for the people who need the accommodation most.
So what does a leader do with that?
Stop treating self-advocacy as the qualifying test. If the only people who get what they need are the ones who already know how to ask, you are not measuring capability. You are measuring upbringing. Build the process so it offers rather than waits.
Chapter 5.
Joe Flom, the last surviving name partner of a major New York law firm, and Gladwell's demonstration that a career can be built out of other people's rejections. Flom is Jewish at a moment when the white shoe firms will not hire Jewish lawyers. So he and his peers take the work the good firms consider beneath them, which at the time includes proxy fights and hostile takeovers. Then the 1970s arrive, hostile takeovers become the most lucrative work in American law, and the only people with 20 years of practice at it are the people who were excluded.
Luck as accumulated exclusion.
Plus two more advantages. Demographic luck, born in the 1930s, a small birth cohort, so smaller classes and less competition all the way up. And parents in the garment trade, which Gladwell uses to introduce what he calls meaningful work. Work with autonomy, work with complexity, and work with a clear connection between effort and reward. He argues children who watch that kind of work at home learn that effort pays.
And those three conditions
are a decent definition of a job a neurodivergent professional can hold for a decade. Autonomy over how, complexity worth the attention, and a visible line from what you did to what came back. Take away the third one, and you are asking someone with a variable internal sense of progress to run on faith.
Then the plane crashes.
The most argued over chapter in the book. Gladwell examines a period of very poor safety performance at Korean Air, including the crash of Flight 801 at Guam in 1997 and a 1990 Avianca crash on Long Island where a plane ran out of fuel.
What is his claim?
That the crashes involved a communication failure he calls mitigated speech. The junior officer sees the problem and softens the warning so far that the captain never registers it. In the Avianca case, the crew tells air traffic control the plane is low on fuel, but never uses the word emergency, which is the word that would have changed everything. Gladwell connects this to Geert Hofstede's power distance index, a measure of how much a culture defers to authority, and argues that high power distance plus a cockpit is dangerous.
And the fix.
This is why the chapter earns its place. Korean Air brought in an outside consultant, David Greenberg, and the fix was to make the language of the cockpit explicit and to run operations in English, which gave crews a second identity with different rules. The airline's safety record improved dramatically. The solution was not to change anyone's culture. It was to make the communication direct.
And there it is.
There it is. An entire industry concluded that indirect, softened, status-aware speech kills people and rebuilt its protocols around saying the true thing plainly, which is what autistic communication does natively and which is the exact trait that gets people marked as blunt in performance reviews. Aviation calls it a safety standard. Offices call it a soft skills problem.
Say the leadership version.
If your organization requires people to read hints in order to survive, you have built a cockpit with mitigated speech in it. And there is a name for the mismatch on the research side. The double empathy problem, described by Damian Milton in 2012, reframes communication breakdown between autistic and non-autistic people as mutual, a two-way failure, rather than a deficit belonging to the autistic person. Korean Air's fix is the double empathy problem solved by policy.
The last two chapters.
Rice Paddies and Math, where he argues that the persistence rewarded by wet rice agriculture, plus a number naming system in Chinese that makes arithmetic more transparent, contribute to mathematics performance. And then KIPP Academy in the Bronx, where the school day is long and the summer is short, built on Carl Alexander's Baltimore research showing that the achievement gap between richer and poorer children widens mostly over the summer, when school stops.
The neurodivergent line through both.
Persistence at hard problems is a function of environment and framing, not a fixed trait of a person. And summer learning loss is a structure story. Remove the structure and outcomes diverge, which is the argument this show keeps landing on. The environment carries the work, from Clear's cues in episode 2 to Drucker's time log in episode 3.
What has not held up?
the 10,000-hour rule, which is a shame because it is the only thing most people remember. In 2014, Brooke McNamara, David Hambrick, and Frederick Oswald published a meta-analysis in Psychological Science covering every major domain where deliberate practice had been studied. Practice explained 26% of the variance in performance for games, 21% for music, 18% for sports, 4% for education, and less than 1% for professions.
Less than 1% for professions.
Which is the category every executive quoting the rule in a boardroom belongs to. Their conclusion was that deliberate practice matters and is nowhere near as decisive as claimed.
And Erickson, whose research it came from,
objected publicly and repeatedly. His position was that Gladwell invented the round number, that the violin study reported an average rather than a threshold, and that the quality and structure of practice, with a teacher and immediate feedback, is the actual finding. 10,000 is a headline, not a result.
The Korean Air chapter.
Widely criticized for sliding from a communication problem into national character. Critics argue Hofstede's indices are blunt instruments, and that attributing crashes to Korean culture flattens specific failures of training, scheduling, and management into an ethnic explanation. The mitigated speech mechanism is solid and well-supported in aviation safety work. The cultural framing around it is contested.
And the method?
The same charge we made against Collins in episode 1. Gladwell selects on the outcome. He finds successful people, then goes looking for the hidden advantage, and never asks how many people had identical advantages and did not become outliers. There were plenty of other boys with January birthdays who never made a roster. As journalism, it is superb. As evidence, it is a set of stories chosen because they fit.
So the tier.
Popular social science, beautifully told, built on real research that it sometimes compresses past what the research says. Which, to be fair, is what he was hired to do, and he is very good at it.
The recap in this show's frame. Outlier says success is manufactured by advantages people cannot see. For neurodivergent leader, or one leading neurodivergent people, the operating instruction is that your sorting mechanisms are inventing the differences they claim to detect. Arbitrary cutoffs generate real gaps, in hockey and in diagnosis alike. Hours require access before they require discipline. Asking for what you need is an inherited skill, not a measure of merit. And an industry that decided plain speech beat status, aware hinting, cut its crash rate. Every one of those is an argument to change the system rather than to fix the person. And AI.
Gladwell's chapters are all about who gets access to hours and who gets to ask. So the honest question is whether these tools widen the gate or simply move it.
Be concrete.
On the practical intelligence problem, a model is a private patient coach for the conversation you do not know how to have. Drafting the accommodation request, rehearsing the negotiation, explaining what a process expects and what the words mean. That is Larry Ou's concerted cultivation, available on demand, and it is genuinely new because the previous version of that resource was having the right parents. On ours, these tools compress the unglamorous part of a domain, so someone with deep interest and no institutional access can build a real portfolio without a lakeside terminal. And on mitigated speech, a model will happily tell you what a hedged sentence was actually trying to say, which is a decoder for anyone who does not read hints natively.
The cautions.
2, as always. The evidence that these tools improve outcomes for neurodivergent workers is early and mostly practitioner reports, so promising practice rather than established. And the Matthew effect applies to AI itself. Whoever has the tools, the time, and the confidence to use them well accumulates advantage fastest, which is this entire book restated in the present tense. If a leader wants AI to close a gap rather than widen one, access has to be deliberate. Otherwise, the January babies win again.
Nora, thank you.
Thank you.
That is Outliers. Next time on 60 Books, Turn the Ship Around by L. David Marquet, a nuclear submarine captain who stopped giving orders, and what happened to his crew. I'm Miles. See you then.